This morning's scripture reading will come from Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 through 25. That is Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 through 25. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." Out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field, every bird of the air, and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called each living creature, that was its name. So Adam gave names to all cattle, to all birds of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept. He took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, he made into woman, and he brought her to the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." And they were both naked, and the man and his wife, and were not ashamed.
Well, I bid you good morning, and I'm very happy to be with you. My name is Ralph Walker, and I am here with my wife, Paula, who is going to be speaking to the ladies in a little while, and spoke to them yesterday in one of the sessions. We're really happy to be with you this weekend. The shepherds of this congregation have asked us to come here and to talk about marriage, and I think our qualifications are as follows. We've been married for a long time, happily. And we've raised three daughters who love the Lord and serve Him. And I attribute much, if not most or all of that, to my wife's influence in the lives of her daughters. But more importantly than those things, we believe that God has answers for us in our marriages, that His answers are found in the Word. And though that is an ancient book, it is the original plan of God, as you just heard it read by our brother. We're going to be in that chapter in Genesis in just a moment and talk again about that. But I believe that if we'll follow God's plan, we're going to have good marriages. That doesn't mean we have perfect marriages. It doesn't mean we have no problems in our marriages, because we're bringing together people who have different backgrounds and different ideas and different genders. And all those things require us to mesh and meld our lives together. And that takes time. And we'll talk about some of those things this weekend. I'm glad you're here. And it was great to be together with the brothers and sisters yesterday and to talk about our preliminary lessons. I won't go back through that. But we're looking at the passage in Genesis because I believe that it provides for us the foundational truths for what it means to have a great marriage. And if you're in a great one, you'll find yourself saying, "Yep, that's exactly right. That's true." If you're not in a great one, you may say, "I hadn't thought about that before," or "I needed that," and that's good. And if you're not married, I hope you'll look forward to a relationship that will be based on those very concepts, those ideas that we find in Genesis chapter 2. There are four of them, and we've talked already about the matter of priority, leaving the mother and father. And now we'll look at the second of those, the foundation of pursuit. A class of young children were asked the question, "What does being married to one person for life, what is that called?" And one little boy raised his hand, and the teacher said, "Yes." And he said, "Monotony." Well, that may be true, but that's not what it's called. It is called monogamy. Gami being together, and mono, two together as one. It can get monotonous, and we want to avoid that. Newton had a third law of motion, and that third law of motion was that for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. God's work in our lives is that way. We've come here today to celebrate a death, which means life for us. You ever think about that? It's death that means life. We love sinners but hate sin. We lead by what? Serving. We gain by what? Surrendering or giving up. And in this passage, in Genesis, particularly, and I'm going to use a word that's found in the King James Version because it intrigues me, we find those two opposites. And they're stated very quickly in the passage. For this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother, and King James Version, cleave to his wife. Leave and cleave. The word cleave is an interesting word. I don't know if you know what a homograph is. A homograph is two words that sound alike. They are written alike, but they may not sound alike. They are written the same. For example, T-E-A-R. It can be tear, or it can be tear. Some other homographs, B-A-S-S. It can be something you catch, a bass, or it could be a part you sing, bass. B-U-F-F-E-T, preachers sometimes cite it as justification for overeating. The Apostle Paul said, I buffet my body daily, meaning to beat it. But some preachers prefer the translation, I buffet my body daily. D-O-E-S, it can be the word does, or it can be the multiple of female deer, does. And M-O-P-E-D, which can be something you ride with great joy, or if they're all sold out and there are no more mopeds, you may have spent the day moping. You moped about that. Those are words that are spelled the same, but are not pronounced the same and do not have the same meaning. There is, to my knowledge, only one homograph that is also an antonym. Now, I know you're saying, man, we're in all this English stuff. Do we have to be here? I just find this interesting. An antonym are words that mean the opposite of each other. And cleave is such a word because it can mean to separate. A cleaver separates meats, or you cleave something, cut it in half with a sword. But in the King James Version of the Bible, the word is also used to mean to join together. So the same word, spelled the same way, pronounced the same way, has exact opposite meanings. I don't know of any other word in the English language that is that. And this word is being used this way. And let me just say this at the very beginning. If you don't work at cleaving to your wife, you will cleave your marriage in two. You better bring it together or you're going to find yourselves being increasingly separated from each other. So what do we mean when we say cleave to your wife? For this cause or reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife. The New American Standard says be joined to his wife, and that's good. That's an accurate translation of the word. It means to pursue and to cling to passionately or zealously. It means to be faithfully committed to catch by pursuit, to follow after. Let me show you a different use of the same word in the Hebrew tongue, translated a little differently. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, Deuteronomy chapter 13 and verse 4. Thanks for humoring me and turning in your Bibles. If you don't have a Bible, grab a songbook and rustle some pages. It just makes me feel good, okay? I feel good. Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 4. You shall follow the Lord your God and fear him. You shall keep his commandments, listen to his voice, serve him, and then this word, and cling to him. That word cling is our word. In the King James, it could say, and you shall cleave to him. Cling to him. It's more than just hearing what he has to say. That's almost the culmination of all those statements that are made at the beginning of the verse. After you've listened to him and you've followed his commandments and you've heard him, grab him. Cling to him. Hold on to him. Clutch him and hold on. It is what Mary did to Jesus. Mary Magdalene, when she met him at the tomb. He says to her, stop clinging to me. Literally, that's what he says. He doesn't say, don't touch me. He's not saying, don't touch me. He is saying, as she is clutching him, he's saying, don't cling to me. I've got to go to my Father. Don't hang on to me. And that's the concept that we're talking about. As we leave father and mother, we cling to or cleave to our mates. Now, let me just ask you a question to think about. Do you think Adam and Eve had any trouble cleaving to each other? Think about it for a moment. Think about the setting. You think they had any trouble finding their whole life being tied up in each other? And I think most of us would say, no, it's pretty easy for them. Why? Well, first of all, they had no distractions. There wasn't another man going by that Eve said, my husband dresses like a slob compared to that guy. There was no other woman going by that Adam said, have you ever thought about wearing your hair like her? There were no distractions of best friends. There were no distractions of children. When this is spoken, leave your mother and father and cleave to your wife. It seems like, well, that's a very easy thing for them to do. And then add to that this. It doesn't seem like there are a lot of distractions about work. I mean, they have a pretty simple commandment from God. It is simply this. They're to take care of the garden. They're to be fruitful and multiply. So they work, they eat, they replenish the earth. Sounds pretty simple. You don't need a day planner to do that. You know, what is it we're doing today? Well, it's what we did yesterday. What's that? We cultivate this garden. Do we have to make visits to other people, take care of aging parents, watch over children? No, we just take care of the garden. We do that together. There's two of us. We work together in this. And then we're going to eat together. And you don't have to worry about, well, do you have bowling night tonight? Or are you going to be gone to the ladies' meeting this evening at the PTA? Nope. We're going to eat supper together. And we're going to eat breakfast together. We're going to eat lunch together. I mean, it seems like it is very easy for them to focus their lives on each other. But let me tell you something. That same commandment that's given to them and about them is also given to all of us. So it isn't as though God expects us to do something different than they did because we live in a different culture. Even though we may have distractions they didn't have, God still calls on us to cling to each other. To make that happen in our lives. God didn't set Adam and Eve up in this idyllic paradise that we can't equal, but then tell us we got to do all the things that they did. It is possible for us, and not only possible, it is enjoined upon us to do the very same thing that they did. And I want to tell you, there could very well have been issues that came up in their lives. And I mentioned some of those yesterday. It came up in their lives that might have caused that clinging to each other to diminish and for them to find a little more independence of each other, maybe even find some distance between them. I'm convinced Adam and Eve had things they argued about. They had issues in their lives, from the loss of their home to the aging that started taking place to the death of their child to Eve's anguish over needing to replace that child, Abel, and finding only her succor to be in Seth as he comes along behind that. Labor becomes hard. You know, you ever think about that? I've thought about that. I'm going to tell you, when I was a boy, I grew up in Tampa, Florida. And in Florida, we have these sand spurs. Never seen sand spurs. I guess the best way to describe them is It is a plant version of a knight's mace. You remember the mace? It was that big ball with all the spikes on it. It's a smaller version of that. And they lay in the ground and they wait for children's bare feet. And they grow on a stalk, and there's a whole bunch of them that run up and down that stalk, and they're green and really, really sharp when they're fresh, and worse when they turn brown, they get brittle and break off in your feet. Nasty things. And I remember one day finally reading the passage here where Adam's curse, one of the curses is that the ground from this point on will bring forth thorns and thistles, and I cursed him that day. I said, you're at fault. All those sand spurs that I got in my feet that got infected, and I had to have my parents pull out with tweezers and all that digging in with pocket knives and pen knives to get them out of my feet. That's your fault, Adam. It's your fault. Now, I want you to think about this, because not only is that true, but they will work by the sweat of their brow. Now, I don't want to go into a lot of detail about this, but if that's a curse because they sinned, then what does that mean before they sinned? They didn't need that. They didn't need sweatbands. They didn't need deodorant. They worked and they didn't sweat. It was idyllic. It's great. Like working in a pool all day long. You know, you don't sweat at all. Now, what do you think that means after they start sweating? Who do you think's blaming who for that? You know, sweat's dripping down in your eyes and you're thinking, it wasn't this way before you ate that fruit. And she says, well, it wasn't that way before you yielded to me the authority that you should have had. You should have slapped that fruit out of my hand before I ate it. Now there's a fight. So they do have causes for disagreement. And then this last thing, they're a long time together. That's a long life that they live, hundreds of years together. And there's a sense in which you'd say, oh, isn't that sweet? I'll bet they just got to love each other more and more and more. But sometimes it works the other way. Familiarity breeds contempt. And they may have gotten tired of each other. My point is this. Adam and Eve don't have the idyllic marriage, and we look at it and say, well, yeah, of course it's easy for them to leave their father and mother because they didn't have them. And it's easy for them to cleave to each other because that's all they had. But you're asking us to do something different. No, they had difficulties. They had problems. And maybe some of those problems were worse than the ones that we encounter in our own marriages. I said to the men yesterday, I made this statement. I'll say it in front of the ladies so you can nudge your husbands if you want on this. When a girl marries, she exchanges the attention of many men for the inattention of one. And that shouldn't be so. That shouldn't be so. We shouldn't have inattentiveness in our lives. And I want you to look at a passage with me for just a moment. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 24. I'll give you a head start to get there. Deuteronomy chapter 24. You know, I hear sometimes people saying things like, you know, the Bible's not very fair to women, and particularly God doesn't seem to love women very much and doesn't give them very much credit, and he doesn't treat them as anything more than just property. I want you to remember this passage when either you think that or somebody says that. Deuteronomy chapter 24, I'm looking at verse 5. When a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out with the army, nor be charged with any duty. He shall be free at home 1 year and shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken. Isn't that something? Do you think about that? A guy gets married and the army says, you go home. You go home. For how long? A year? Man, a full year? I don't have to serve in the military for a year? No. What about government service? No. Mm-mm. You were working in the king's palace? You go home. For how long? A year? What am I supposed to do for that year? Here it is. Every day planner. Every day. Make your wife happy. And all the women said, amen. You know? Make your wife happy. Make your wife happy. Give happiness to your wife. Now look at that. Now sometimes I think we have this idea, well, it just happens. But even God understood. It doesn't just happen. You have to work at that. And that's the point that's being made. You're not to be distracted from making your wife happy. That doesn't mean he didn't work at all. He took care of his family and he had his regular job. But the government, the military forces did not take him from his family so that he could just concentrate on making his wife happy. How did he do that? I'm sure by bonding with her, by finding out, what do you like to do? What will make you happy? What will make you happy? I'm here to give you that. That is my job as your husband. Now, I think that works both ways. You know, and the only way you really know is trial and error, asking questions. You know, you have to ask questions. What makes you happy? What do you like? Because, guys, if you don't know what kind of movies your wife likes, you need to be asking. You say, oh, she loves the Bourne series. Probably not. Unless she's got a thing for Jason Bourne, now, then she may. But she has things she likes. My wife loves When Calls the Heart. I tried watching that. I got two seasons in, and I found myself losing my manhood. And I was wanting quiche all the time. And then the plot just got beyond me. But my wife loves that. My daughters love that. You know, they love Little Women. I do watch that with them. There are things I know my wife likes and things that my wife doesn't like. And we try to work those things out. And she knows about me. And some of that's by trial and error, but some of that's by asking. But you got to ask those kind of questions and not get too frustrated. It reminds me of the woman who said to her neighbor, you know, she's very unhappy. She said, my husband doesn't show any interest in what I do. All he cares about is whatever it is he does at that place, wherever it is he works. Is this on? Is this on? Because that was funny. All he cares about is whatever it is he does at that place, wherever it is he works. He didn't care about me. Well, I think that probably calls for looking in a mirror. You know, and you women may say, oh yeah, I know exactly what he wants because men are so simple and so easy to understand. I know exactly. You may not. We probably need to be asking those questions. If we're going to cling to one another, we have to know what it is we're clinging to. And we have trouble continuing the pursuit of things. The fervor for pursuit is often lost. That's not just lost in our spousal relationships, but jobs, hobbies, self-improvement, even our spiritual relationships. We find ourselves not doing this. It's getting better, 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 better. Nor is it static, 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 static. And sometimes it may be it's getting worse, getting worse, getting worse. But for most of us, it's this kind of thing. Yeah, it's getting better, it's getting better. Now it's lagging. And then it's getting better, now it's lagging. It's an up and down relationship. And once we understand that, then we know when to work on reconcentrating ourselves. Because for most of us, and particularly is this true for the man's heart, we are more excited about the chase than the catch. We're more excited about the chase than the catch. There is something about the pursuit that really excites men particularly, but that can also be true for women. And then once we're there, it just doesn't quite seem to be the same. And so we either take off after another thing, we're distracted, you know, the dog, squirrel, you know, we're drawn away. Can I tell you something, ladies? I'm going to tell you, this will help you. If you want to have a conversation with your husbands and you say, let's go out to eat so we can talk, don't go to any place that has sports in the title. And don't go anywhere where there's a TV screen. Or if you do go where there's a TV screen, make certain your husband cannot see it nor the reflection of it in any mirrors or windows. Just make certain of that. Because I'm going to tell you something, and this is true. We are drawn to the flicker. We are. We are like dogs with squirrels. You know, and so you're talking, you're saying, I'm just so worried about mom. She's not doing well and she's sick. And we're looking up because it just changed screens there. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that. And we'll come back And we'll concentrate again. And at times I'm sitting there looking at my wife and I'm thinking, stay here, stay here. Don't move. And then, bam, there it is again. Did you see that? We're distracted by those things. We become distracted in our relationships. Or we become bored. You know, there is something to be said for sameness that's good, and there's something to be said for it that can become very dangerous. A woman fixed meatloaf on Sunday for her husband because he really liked meatloaf. He loved it. And then on Monday, she reheated it. And on Tuesday, she had meatloaf sandwiches. And then she had fried meatloaf on Wednesday. And then she wondered why he suddenly hates meatloaf. Well, that can happen if we don't change up the sameness that's in our relationships. We've got to be very careful about that. And our culture doesn't help us. Let me say this. This idea of clinging to, this is not something that happens naturally. It is what is being ordered. Just like I said to you yesterday, it is not natural to say, I'm married, my parents are no longer the major influence in my life. They're not. That's not a natural thing. That is an order given. For this cause, a man shall do this. Leave your mother and father and do this. Cling to your wife. If you're thinking, well, it just happens every day. It's just a natural thing. I just love my wife so much. It's a natural thing. I love my husband so much. It is normal for me to cling to him. You're missing it. And you may have bought into our culture, because our culture teaches us that love is one of those things that happens and is irresistible and you can't do anything about it. Disney certainly does. In most Disney movies, there's no real pursuit at all. They fall in love at first sight. Now, I know they have to work out a lot of things like dragons and witches and vertically challenged men and all those other kinds of things. But it's one of those things that just happens. It's a chemical reaction. You can't control it. Hollywood romances tend to show couples that are in conflict at first, and then they're working hard at distancing themselves or closing the gap, and then they fall in love and they relax and they abandon the pursuit mode altogether. That's a typical movie plot. Sorry, spoiler alert. And in our culture, pursuing somebody, clinging to them, can be seen as either a weakness or an obsession. Do you think about that? I mean, it may be that even as I was talking about that word, clinging to your mate, some of you may have said, I'm kind of uncomfortable with that. That seems like you're maybe just too dependent on somebody. That's obsessive. Or you're so weak that you're just clutching on to somebody. But the Bible uses that term. Listen, the Bible uses that term. Cling to your spouse. That you need to clutch them and hold on to them. We know that pursuit is important in the relationship. We know that. We know that in our initial pursuit of our mates. But look at somebody who's been married and wasn't successful at it because they didn't do the things that God said do. And now they're in the market because their mate has left them, abandoned them because they weren't doing what they ought to do. And now look at them as they begin to look for another partner, the lengths they'll go. Lose weight, change your hairstyle, work on romance, spend money, get a new job, give up hobbies. What if we worked that hard in the original relationship? What if we had done all those things originally? You think maybe we might have saved ourselves and others a great deal of pain and hurt? So as we bring this lesson to a close, let me give you some tips for communicating admiration and love for your spouse. Just some practical tips from that great statement, cleave to your wife. Number one, be sincere. I mean, find sincere things to compliment and express your admiration and love for. Insincerity certainly doesn't fly with God, and most of the time it doesn't with our spouses. So find things that you truly can be admiring about. And number two, men compliment every aspect of her life, not just her looks. I didn't get a chance yesterday in the men's class when we were talking about Proverbs chapter 31 to go into as much detail as I'd like. So I'd kind of like to revisit that very quickly, especially for men. But I want to just offer a couple of thoughts to you about praising her. Verse 28 and following says, her children rise up and bless her, and her husband also. And he praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Now, I want to stop there, and I want to suggest a couple of things about that passage right there. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Where do you think they got that from? You think they were naturally inclined that way? No, the answer is found as to why they do that in the second part of that verse. Men, you want your children to honor and admire and praise your wife, then you do it in their presence. You do that. You talk about how important she is to you. And you don't. It's not just a matter of, hey, you show some respect to your mother. It's by you showing respect to their mother that they will learn to do that. You praise her for what she is. And you point that out to the children, and they will learn to rise up and call her blessed. And while that means a great deal, as a father, it means a great deal to have my children respect me and state that about me, that they like and that they appreciate and that they admire. That means a lot to me, but it doesn't hold a candle to the way I feel when my wife does that. And my daughters learned that because my wife is good at that. And it's important for us to do that. And note this, her husband also praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. You know, this is not an arrogance, and it's not an unhealthy thing. But we want to know we're doing well compared to others. We want to know that. I mean, that's why we run races against other people. That's why we play games against other teams. It's why we do trivia with other people. It's not just what we know, but we know we're doing well if we're doing well compared to other people. And that's not the only benchmark, but it is something. And so we need to think in those terms. We need to think in terms of praising our wives about the things that they are trying to do and be in this world. Praise her in public. Notice it says, her husband praises her, saying, and he is in the gates of the city. I mean, he's comparing her favorably with other women who are praiseworthy. And that's an important point, guys. It's not enough to say, hey, you know what? Your chicken and dumplings are better than Aunt Jan's. I throw up every time I eat hers. That's not much of a comparison. Many other women, daughters, have done nobly, but you excel them all. And praise her for the better things. Beauty and charm are fine, but they're lesser qualities than the spiritual. And I know we men are drawn by the physical looks of our mates. I know that. I was. But that's not the most important thing about the wife I married. It's her spiritual character. It's what she is in her heart. And men, may I say something to you, and seriously for just a moment, just think about this. Women have to compete in a very difficult, terrible marketplace, especially godly women. Because they have to appear attractive and beautiful to us while not compromising the moral standards that they have that keep them from being as sensually attractive as the people of this world are. So it's like running a race and their ankles are hobbled together. If they're trying to attract our attention and we keep getting drawn to the sensual things of this world, And so we need to be very careful about that. You know, Job made that statement, I've made a covenant with my eyes. We men need to make covenants with our eyes. That we are not constantly drawn to the allures of this world and drawn away from the real beauty of the women God gave us. Leo Tolstoy once said, what a strange illusion it is to suppose that beauty is goodness. I've always loved that line. What a strange illusion it is to suppose that beauty is goodness. And I'll tell you something, that's really, I love Disney movies and I got a bunch of them, but that's really what Disney movies teach children. Beauty is goodness. You ever notice that? With the exception of Maleficent in one of the earlier movies, most of the wicked people are really ugly. And you know exactly who the good people are until we got thrown that curve in Frozen when that prince was really handsome and likable, and it turns out, it doesn't work out that way, for those of you who haven't seen it. I was joking with my granddaughters, and I was saying, who's your favorite Disney princess? Who's your favorite Disney princess? And they all give me the list of who their favorite is, and they say, how about you, Papa? Who's your favorite? And I say, Ursula. And one of my granddaughters immediately said, no, Papa, she's not a princess. She's ugly. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. Now, think about that for a minute, because that's a teachable moment. Do we just love beauty and think it's goodness? Or do we love the deeper beauty that is found in a godly woman? Praise your women for that. What Peter calls the imperishable qualities of a gentle and quiet spirit. Oh, I think a woman longs and loves to be told she's beautiful on the outside. But a godly woman should be told tenfold times how beautiful her soul and spirit are in the sight of God. So I want you to think about that. I want to close by reading you something that I just think talks about the cleaving concept. A man named Bill Bonney's a psychologist, and he gave me this letter that was written by a colleague of his. I'm going to close with this. It was a busy morning, about 8:30, when an elderly gentleman in his 80s arrived to have stitches removed from his thumb. He said he was in a hurry as he had an appointment at 9 o'clock. I took his vital signs and had him take a seat, knowing it'd be over an hour before someone would be able to see him. And I saw him looking at his watch and decided, since I was not busy with another patient, I'd evaluate his wound, and on exam, it was well healed. So I talked to one of the doctors, and I got the needed supplies to remove his sutures and redress his wound. While taking care of his wound, I asked him if he had another doctor's appointment that morning, as he was in such a hurry. A gentleman told me no, that he needed to go to the nursing home to eat breakfast with his wife. I inquired as to her health, and he told me she had been there for a while, and she was a victim of Alzheimer's. As we talked, I asked if he'd be upset if he was a bit late. He replied she no longer knew who he was, that she'd not recognized him in 5 years now. So I was surprised, and I asked him, and you still go every morning? Even though she doesn't know who you are? He smiled as he patted my hand, and he said, she doesn't know me, but I still know who she is. I had to hold back tears as he left. I had goosebumps on my arm, and I thought, that's the kind of love I want in my life. True love is neither physical nor romantic. True love is an acceptance of all that is, has been, will be, and will not be. For this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. We'll stop there. Thank you for your thoughts.